Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. On July 23, 2003, long after four-letter words and stand-up comedy lost their ability to shock, Lenny Bruce, who started the trend, was posthumously pardoned for his 1964 obscenity conviction. New York Governor George Pataki granted the pardon after a campaign that included Bruce's daughter, his former wife and entertainers such as Robin Williams, the Smothers Brothers, and Penn and Teller. Freedom of speech is one of the greatest American liberties, and I hope this pardon serves as a reminder of the precious freedoms we're fighting to preserve as we continue to wage the war on terror, Pataki said. It was the first posthumous pardon in the New York State history, and Bruce supporters called the decision a victory for the First Amendment. Our guest this week, Ronald Collins, has written a book on the trials of Lenny Bruce. He'll be interviewed by Talking History's Eileen Dugan. And after that, Thomas Fleming returns to provide us with some history on the fate of generals who have sought the White House in the past, General Wesley Clark being only the latest of many. But first, let's hear from Dan Roberts in part two of his three-part series in his A Moment in Time on the Battle of Kings Mountain.
The turning point of the American Revolution in the South is considered by many to be Kings Mountain. The key to that battle was the so-called Backwater Men.
A Moment in Time with Dan Roberts.
In the late 1770s, the British rightly suspected that there were many loyalists in the South willing to bolster the regular army's attempts to put the rebellion down there. What they did not reckon was there were also many who were deeply committed to the Patriot cause, or at least willing to resist the British as invaders. Since the outbreak of hostilities in 1775, bitter, low-grade partisan warfare had divided neighbors and families throughout the Carolinas, particularly in the eastern counties. After the fall of Charleston in May 1780, General Cornwallis moved his army in three groups northwest into the heartland. On the right flank of the main body was Colonel Bannister Tarleton, whose brutality in victory at Waxhaws on May 29th and elsewhere that summer earned him forever the sobriquet Bloody Ban. On the left was Major Patrick Ferguson. In September 1780, Ferguson issued an open warning to the Patriot groups that were continuing their resistance in the Alpine valleys east of the mountains. Among them were the Backwater Men, hard-working, tough, hardy, and deeply religious Scot-Irish immigrants who had settled in the valleys of the Holston, Watauga, and French Broad Rivers, these backwaters which flowed west into the Tennessee and Mississippi. They had settled there to protect their families, secure their independence, and practice their fierce Presbyterian faith. When Ferguson threatened to lay waste their country and hang their leaders, it was as if he had stuck his arm in a hornet's nest. Next time, Run to Ground on Kings Mountain. At the University of Richmond, this is Dan Roberts.
As I reported at the start of today's program, the governor of New York recently issued a posthumous pardon of Lenny Bruce for his 1964 obscenity conviction. What better time to look back at the legal battles of the controversial stand-up comedian? To help us do that, Talking History's Eileen Dugan called on Ronald Collins, the author of The Trials of Lenny Bruce.
Now, the argument, if Lenny Bruce is not allowed you these words, and after all, the context, the words he used, if he were to just shout them senselessly on a street corner, but there's a point of view so it is not obscene. I don't even want that. What I want the people, my friends, to dig is the lie. That you should say the words and be able to say the words in the streetcar if you do them. Respectability means under the covers. That's what it means.
Alive, Lenny Bruce was considered offensive, sick, and threatening. Dead, he was turned into a martyr of the First Amendment, mourned in song by Simon Garfunkel and Bob Dylan, portrayed by Dustin Hoffman in a Bob Fosse film, and there he is on the cover of the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper album. Who killed Lenny Bruce became a catchphrase of the late 60s. But who was, what was, Lenny Bruce, and why was he so dangerous? With us today to examine the legal battles of this most controversial comedian is David M. Scover, professor of law at Seattle University Law School. Mr. Scover and fellow legal scholar Ronald L. Collins are the co-authors of the recent book, The Trials of Lenny Bruce, The Fall and Rise of an American Icon, a book which has a companion CD, by the way, of some of Lenny's most notorious routines and commentary by fellow comedians. Well, welcome, Mr. Scover.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be with you.
What brought you as a legal scholar to the story of Lenny Bruce?
Well, for some 15 years now, my co-author Ronald Collins and I have written various articles and books on the intersection of law and popular culture. For example, our first book, called The Death of Discourse, which is soon to come out in a second edition, focused on the impact of our mass commercial and entertainment culture, particularly the industries of commercial television, advertising, and pornography, on the state of discourse in America and on our culture's understanding of free speech values. Nadine Strossen, who is a professor at New York Law School and the president of the National ACLU, has long been our friend, and she's really quite familiar with our work. It was Nadine who first suggested that we look into a book project on Lenny Bruce. To paraphrase her, Nadine said, you know, with your interest in popular culture and the First Amendment, you guys really would be perfect candidates for a book on the nature of Lenny Bruce's comedy and on the tragic history of his obscenity trials. So we took up Nadine's suggestion. And as we researched more deeply on the subject, it became clear to us that we were uncovering an incredible legal story, one that had not been told fully or accurately by any of the prior biographers of Lenny Bruce. His trials really are like no other in the history of law. It's a remarkable tale of a man who was the magnet for enough prosecutors to staff an entire state attorney's office, some 12 or more, including, surprisingly, Johnny Cochran Jr., enough defense lawyers to fill a small law firm, you know, some 23, which included famous ones like the civil rights attorney William Kunstler and the celebrated Chicago Law School First Amendment scholar Harry Calvin Jr. and the Supreme Court advocate Ephraim London. And his trials included more judges than have presided over any single body of free speech litigation, even including Thurgood Marshall before he became a Supreme Court justice. And all of this was for misdemeanor obscenity offenses.
Wow. Who was Lenny Bruce anyway? How did he break into comedy?
Well, in the late 1950s and early 1960s, Lenny Bruce was without question the most controversial comedian of his day. He was controversial because he dared to speak the unspeakable about race relations, about religious hypocrisy, sexual morality, and political corruption. He lampooned the establishment, whether political, religious, commercial, social authorities, by revealing their hypocrisies at every turn, and sometimes in highly unconventional and offensive ways. Lenny would never hold back in what he said and how he said it. For that reason, he was busted time and again in San Francisco, Chicago, Los Angeles, and New York. Lenny's obscenity trials lasted some 5 years, and they involved thousands of pages of transcripts, all of this for speaking his mind in comedy clubs. And in the end, as you noted in your introduction, Lenny was vindicated as a cultural icon, but not until after he died in 1966 from a drug overdose. But his conviction in New York was never overturned. Remarkably, Lenny died a convicted man, and that conviction stands to this day. This is something that Ron Collins and I are attempting to rectify at this very moment. We are the named petitioners right now, along with Lenny's daughter, Kitty Bruce, in a petition to New York's Governor Pataki to pardon Lenny Bruce posthumously for the criminal conviction that was obtained unconstitutionally in New York in 1964. That is, a conviction obtained in contravention of the First Amendment guarantees of freedom of speech. Now, you also asked how Lenny broke into comedy. In short, Lenny came out of the Jewish burlesque tradition. In his earliest years, he imitated the shtick routines of his mother, the burlesque comedian Sally Marr. But it was really in the Los Angeles region strip clubs when he began emceeing in what he called the toilets that he developed the style for which he became rightfully famous. There he created some of his most brilliant and famous routines, including Las Vegas Tits and Ass, Two is a Preposition, Come as a Verb, and Psychopathia Sexualis.
Well, you talk about how Lenny was able to speak the unspeakable. I mean, what was the purpose of his comedy? I mean, was he just using these offensive words to people at that time offensive just to shock them, or why was he doing this?
In short, Bruce's purpose was to expose the lie. He'd use that phrase a lot. He'd say, dig the lie. He wanted to reveal the hypocrisies that underlay establishment forces of religion, politics, and sexual morality. In many of his routines, by the way, the character of language itself, that is, whether or not it was truly dirty, was the very point. He would ask, quite reasonably, why we're allowed to perform sexual practices, and yet we're not allowed to speak about them. He used to argue, you know, we should be able to say on the streets, or I should be able to say in this club, what we all do in the bedroom. And even more importantly, Lenny had a belief. Now, you might consider this belief naive or not, but he certainly had a strong belief that to use taboo words would diffuse them, of their power to shock, to injure, to wound, to immobilize. And thus we have from him the notorious routine called nigger, nigger, where he used not only that word, but all manner of opprobrious racial epithets.
Was Lenny Bruce the only one of his time who was using such language or shocking people?
Oh, certainly not. But, I mean, there was Moms Mabley, for example, who was performing in Harlem and who would have, given Lenny a run for his money, if not beaten him in that department. But the difference is Moms Mabley was playing to a largely black audience in an area where the police were unconcerned about this. Lenny was increasingly playing to conventional clubs in front of middle-class women and men.
And it was the women part that especially became a sticking point with the government, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. Ironically, the prosecutors would continue to repeat that there were women in the audience, as though, to, you know, that would alone shock the juries and the judges.
On what grounds did authorities begin to crack down on Lenny Bruce?
Well, Lenny Bruce was arrested and convicted for word crimes, and the formal charges were always obscenity. But unofficially, the real concern was not Lenny's four-letter, six-letter, 10-letter dirty words, but the sum and substance of his ideas. Essentially, when Lenny Bruce was arrested and convicted in very Catholic Chicago for his Christ and Moses routine, he was being penalized for mocking the Pope. He couldn't be constitutionally charged with blasphemy, but the concern was blasphemy nonetheless. And when Lenny Bruce was arrested and convicted in New York, highly democratic New York, for his hauling ass to save her ass routine, he was being penalized for degrading America's lofty image of Jacqueline Kennedy only months after the president's assassination. And again, he couldn't be constitutionally charged for seditious libel, but the concern was libel of a public figure nonetheless.
Was all of this due to a public outcry to silence him?
No, there was never a public outcry to silence Lenny Bruce.
So what did the public think of Lenny Bruce in general and of his arrests?
Well, most members of the general public knew little, if anything, about him, at least more than they read in the SF Chicago, LA, or New York newspapers. The very few newspaper editorials that opined about Bruce's obscenity cases seemed to question the wisdom of prosecutorial zeal in pursuing Lenny Bruce. And of course, Lenny's audiences generally consisted of his diehard fans. So in short, it's clear that Lenny Bruce's prosecutions were not the result of some general public call to silence him.
In your book, you talk about some of his major trials in cities like Los Angeles and New York City and Chicago, and how he was frequently being defended on grounds of the First Amendment. There's a famous line of, give me someone who swings with the First Amendment. How do we know that Lenny Bruce wasn't simply hiding behind the First Amendment?
Well, that is indeed a devil's advocate question. Early on in the long saga of his obscenity trials, when Lenny was being prosecuted in San Francisco for his performances at the Jazz Workshop, he actually demanded a jury trial, and this was against the advice of his fine attorney at the time, Albert Bendick, because Lenny believed that the media publicity of a jury trial would assist his career. Now, this was long before Lenny realized that he would be subject to prosecution after prosecution, and that these trials would end up killing his career, whether they were litigated before a judge or jury. But what really is the best evidence that Lenny wasn't hiding behind the First Amendment to protect his humor? In my opinion, it is that over time, Lenny demonstrated an unquestionably obsessive interest in the law. In fact, in his later comedy club gigs, he relinquished all of the routines that had made him famous, and he would read from his trial transcripts at length. He would comment on the value and importance of protecting his, you know, comedy commentaries under the First Amendment. So he exhibited a deep-seated belief that the First Amendment would guarantee his right to speak on his socially significant topics in the fashion that he chose to speak on them. By that time, he'd come to realize that maybe he would not originally have chosen this role, but that he had now become a First Amendment victim and an important free speech advocate. And it was on that basis that he continued to go out on the stage night after night, knowing he would be subject to arrest and knowing he would be spending more time and more money on these fruitless prosecutions.
Did Lenny Bruce have any champions, any defenders among the famous?
Well, Lenny Bruce had two sets of angels, in my mind, who acted generously and fearlessly in his behalf, and Ron and I, in fact, list them all in an appendix that we have at the end of the book. We list them as Lenny's First Amendment heroes. First, there were the club owners. These were the men and women who risked their economic and their legal fortunes on continuing to hire Bruce, even after the obscenity battles had begun and had begun losing. Who do they include? Well, the likes of Herb Cohen at the Unicorn in Los Angeles, Doug Weston at the Troubadour in Beverly Hills. There was Alan Ribbeck at Chicago's famous Gate of Horn, which was eventually shut down because Ribbeck sponsored Lenny Bruce. And then there were Howard and Ellis Solomon at New York's Cafe Ogogo, and they were the co-defendants in the 1964 prosecution of Lenny Bruce. The second set of First Amendment heroes were the defense attorneys who represented Bruce, generally gratis, since Lenny had a habit of stiffing his lawyers. Knowing that they would likely receive nothing for their labors, these attorneys would nevertheless carry a legal lance to the best of their extraordinary abilities. And this set includes, among many others now, the amazing trio that won the appeal of Lenny's Chicago obscenity conviction, as Harry Calvin Jr., whom I mentioned before, William Ming, who had co-authored the Supreme Court brief with Thurgood Marshall in the famous Brown versus Board school desegregation case that came before the U.S. Supreme Court, and Maurice Rosenfield, who represented Playboy at the time. And in addition to them, I have to mention Ephraim London, who was Lenny's lead counsel in a New York obscenity trial, a man who won more Supreme Court cases in the area of obscenity than probably any other individual in history.
And what about in the entertainment world?
Well, in the entertainment world, probably the most surprising sponsor, if you will, was an economic sponsor, Phil Spector, who basically floated Lenny Bruce at the end of his life. This was at the period when Lenny Bruce could not be hired in most places, and was running out of money. Phil was there at Lenny Bruce's death and probably gave the most memorable line, the response to the general question, "Who killed Lenny Bruce?" Phil Spector said, "Lenny died of an overdose of police."
We only have a moment remaining, but how would you describe Lenny Bruce's legal legacy and his comedic legacy?
Well, Lenny Bruce is often hailed by comedians as their patron saint. And this is clear. I mean, the reason for this is clear. Lenny's courtroom dramas open the door for comedians like Joan Rivers or Dick Gregory or George Carlin, Robin Williams on his HBO special, and Margaret Cho. In terms of his legal legacy, thanks to Lenny Bruce, the Comedy Club today is America's greatest free speech zone. I mean, nowhere else can you hear the kind of open, robust, and uninhibited speech that you hear in comedy clubs. That is Lenny's greatest legacy.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Scover.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Gig Axelrod, I warn you, Lenny Bruce, if you use the language that you used at that show, your appearance here, then I got completely out of it, you know. But into it enough that I know that we are him and I. I said, you specifically warn me? Yeah, if I warn you that if you use, if I hear of those words, if I hear of those words, if he hears from somebody else that I talk dirty tonight, then I'll be in court again. The judge has heard the word hearsay so much he forgot what the hell it means. That's hearsay, hearsay, hearsay. It's like good night, good night, good night, good night. Thank you, hearsay. That's hearsay over Jack Overrule, over Jack the Rule Off. That's it. Hearsay, hearsay. That's hearsay. When I hear a judge hear this, if I hear of it, you better bring your toothbrush. Now, bring your toothbrush. Now, this means two things to me. The first thing, I swear to God to you, that I heard, but then he explained the other parlance, was that we were compatible. Because a toothbrush is an intimate thing to me. Everybody knows that.
We have been talking with Mr. David M. Scover, professor of law at Seattle University Law School, who with Ronald Collins is the author of The Trials of Lenny Bruce, The Fall and Rise of an American Icon.
George Washington was the first general elected to the presidency, but what followed was a long list of military aspirants to the high office, General Wesley Clark being only the latest. Thomas Fleming provides us with some historical perspective on this electoral phenomenon.
Once upon a time, in 1920 to be exact, another general ran for president. His name was John J. Pershing. He had far better credentials than General Wesley Clark. Pershing had commanded 2 million men in battle against the most formidable adversary yet seen in the world's wars, the Imperial German Army, and he had won. When he returned to America, Congress conferred on him the unprecedented title, General of the Armies. Soon after the armistice, in November 1918, various VIPs nominated Pershing for president. When he revealed he was a Republican, the vice president of the National Republican League thought he was a cinch to repeat General Ulysses S. Grant's performance in 1868. Pershing's supporters ran him in several primaries. He invariably finished an inglorious last. By the time the two parties chose their nominees in 1920, Pershing's name was not even being mentioned in the newspapers. The general and his friends should have paid more attention to the many other generals who ran for the ultimate prize without success. After the victorious Mexican War, Army Commander-in-Chief Winfield Scott, known as the thinking man's soldier, ran against Democrat Franklin Pierce, who had served briefly in the war as a brigadier of volunteers. Scott lost badly. In 1864, General George McClellan ran against Abraham Lincoln. He, too, lost ingloriously. In 1880, General Winfield Scott Hancock, the hero of Gettysburg, ran against James Garfield, who had had a mediocre record as a general of volunteers. Garfield won. Then there is General Douglas MacArthur, who was repeatedly mentioned as a presidential candidate after he won fame in World War I. When President Truman fired MacArthur for mishandling the Korean War in 1951, he returned home to hysterical acclaim with ticker tape parades in major American cities and frantic calls for him to run for president. But when General Dwight D. Eisenhower, the man who had defeated Adolf Hitler's armies, announced he was available as a candidate, MacArthur receded into the shadows. The generals who reached the White House all fit Arthur Schlesinger's brilliant division of America's soldiers into roundheads and cavaliers. Roundheads eschew military glory and lay no claim to brilliance. They are small-d Democrats. Cavaliers are aristocrats with a high opinion of their own brain power. They love glittering uniforms and orotund appeals to glory and patriotism. General Winfield Scott was the prototype cavalier. He designed his own gorgeous uniforms. The soldiers called him Old Fuss and Feathers. The other major general in the Mexican War, Zachary Taylor, wore no visible signs of rank and sat on his horse, Old Whitey, side-saddle during a battle. Taylor became president in 1848. Ulysses Grant, who served in Mexico, was an Old Zach clone. There was not a sign of gold braid on his uniform, and instead of soaring appeals to patriotism and heroism, Grant said, "We shall fight it out along this line if it takes all summer." Ike Eisenhower struck the same low-keyed, "Let's get this job done" note during World War II. The bottom line of this rapid survey would seem to be fatal to General Wesley Clark. Like MacArthur, Pershing, and McClellan, Clark was a star at West Point, graduating first in his class. During Clark's so-called war in Kosovo, he was extraordinarily fond of getting his picture in the papers and on TV in his well-tailored uniform. Moreover, his war was an elitist operation in which all the fighting was done by a handful of pilots and techies in charge of cruise missiles. No large numbers of enlisted men served under Clark and learned to like his ways. Add it all up, and Wesley's appeal to the American voters, outside the core of desperate Democrats searching for someone to beat George Bush, seems to be close to zero.
You've been listening to Thomas Fleming, the author of The Illusion of Victory, America in World War I. And that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. We welcome your comments or suggestions for future shows, which you can send us either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, Joey Skidmore, producer, Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. A Moment in Time is produced by Dan Roberts and distributed by WCVE-FM in Richmond, Virginia. For more information, visit amomentintime.com. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.